I am, as you know, occasionally I will bring my book that I was able to find, that's very difficult to find, from a friend, an Almanac for the Soul, by Marv and Nancy Hiles, and it's just a wonderful series of meditations, and I was struck by this one that's not until tomorrow, December 16th. I worked a little bit ahead, but I thought it was fitting for this time and season. So this is the meditation for December 16th, and it's from James Agee's A Death in the Family. When grief and shock surpass endurance, there occurs phases of exhaustion, of anesthesia, in which relatively little is left and one has the illusion of recognizing and understanding a good deal. Throughout these days, Mary had, during these breathing spells, drawn a kind of solace from the recurrent thought, at least I am enduring it. He's talking, obviously, of Mary, the mother of Jesus. I am aware of what has happened. I am meeting it face to face. I am living through it. There had been even a kind of pride, a desolate kind of pleasure in the feeling. I am carrying a heavier weight than I could have dreamed it possible for a human being to carry. Yet I am living through it. It had, of course, occurred to her that this happens to many people, that it is very common. And she humbled and comforted herself in this thought. I'm not sure if it bears repeating this, because it's a bit, there's a couple internal dialogues going on here. But I thought it was helpful to get a perspective, because this is the time of year, again, when things are supposed to be happy, fun, cheery, and bright, and they are often just the opposite for many of us, for many different reasons. And I love how in this, in James Agee's, this part of this book, he's entering into Mary's space and trying to think, what was Mary thinking at the news of this pregnancy out of wedlock and who she would be giving birth to? And I love that line, throughout these days Mary had, during her breathing spells, drawn a kind of solace from this recurring thought that at least I am enduring it. It's difficult, whatever this is that I'm facing, but I'm enduring it. That's a good thing. And then he goes on to say that it, of course, had occurred to her eventually that this happens to many people, that this is very common, and she humbled and comforted herself with this thought. And I like that as well, because oftentimes I think when we are going through periods of darkness and doubt and struggle, we think we're alone, and to be reminded that actually it's a very common thing to be feeling. It's a very common thing to be experiencing. This is not unusual at all. There is a sense of comfort you can get from that. I mean, it's the old misery loves company, but it's more than just that. It's this sense that, it's related exactly to some of what we're going to talk about today. So we pick up with Genesis 39, where we read that now Joseph was well-built and handsome. So remember that. We were reminded that Joseph is a stud. I was always a little disappointed that it was Donny Osmond who played Joseph in Technicolor Dreamcoat. He obviously had a personal trainer who helped him work out, but I've never thought of Donny Osmond as a stud. I've always thought of him as a little bit cute, kind of corny. I could have thought of a lot, but anyway, he was fine. Now Joseph was well-built and handsome. Sometime later, his master's wife became attracted to Joseph and said, "Sleep with me." He refused and said to his master's wife, "With me here, my master doesn't pay attention to anything in his household. He's put everything he has under my supervision. No one is greater than I am in this household, and he hasn't denied me anything except you, since you are his wife. How could I do this terrible thing and sin against God?" Every single day, she tried to convince him, but he wouldn't agree to sleep with her or even to be with her. One day, when Joseph arrived at the house to do his work, none of the household's men were there. She grabbed his garment, saying, "Lie down with me." But he left his garment in her hands and ran outside. When she realized that he had left his garment in her hands and run outside, she summoned the men of her house and said to them, "Look, my husband brought us a Hebrew to ridicule us. He came to me to lie down with me, but I screamed when he heard me raise my voice and scream. He left his garment with me and ran outside. She kept his garment with her until Joseph's master came home, and she told him the same thing. The Hebrew slave whom you brought to us to ridicule me came to me, but when I raised my voice and screamed, he left his garment with me and ran outside. When Joseph's master heard the thing that his wife told him, "This is what your servant did to me," he was incensed. Joseph's master took him and threw him in jail, the place where the king's prisoners were held. While he was in jail, the Lord was with Joseph and remained loyal to him. He caused the jail's commander to think highly of Joseph. The jail's commander put all of the prisoners in the jail under Joseph's supervision, and he was the one who determined everything that happened there. The jail's commander paid no attention to anything under Joseph's supervision because the Lord was with him and made everything he did successful. So that's very interesting for a number of different reasons, this passage in Genesis 39 about Joseph. And I want to look at the end of this passage first, or towards the end, and I want to use von Rott's translation, which is familiar enough. You'll know the verse. "And he was there in prison, and the Lord was with Joseph and showed him steadfast love." And that's sort of part of the end of verse 20 and the beginning of verse 21. And we touched on this last week, but it bears repeating, I think. We can be in the worst circumstances and the Lord can be with us, showing us his love and favor. I think that's so important, and it's significant enough to stand on its own, right? That it's such a deep and counterintuitive truth that we need to be reminded of it again and again and again, that we can be in the worst circumstances and the Lord can be showing us his favor and love. It almost, I've been tempted over the course of the last few years, occasionally when I run up against a truth like this, of just saying this and then sitting here for 15 minutes in awkward silence. But I won't do that because I'd be more embarrassed than you would be. But I think it's really important to meditate on this. That we can be in terrible circumstances, and simultaneously, the Lord can be showing us his love and favor. And I think we just too often assume that if the Lord is with us and he is blessing us, everything will go well. And that is simply not biblical. It's just not theologically tenable. It's not responsible. The inscrutability of the Lord's providence, the mystery of it all, the unknowability of how God acts, the fact that we can never presume to understand God's will and his ways. This very obvious, deeply biblical fact that we can never presume to know God's will, we can never assume that we have figured God out, should cure us from ever feeling too comfortable, too sure of ourselves when it comes to either God's favor or disfavor. I teach at a school where it is somewhat common for students, and I teach in a department, actually, where it's very common. It's an occupational hazard. People are hearing God's voice all the time, every day, practically. Helping them find parking places, helping them find the perfect internship at the church, helping them. And it's just nauseating that I have to deal with this on a consistent basis. They turn God into their sort of cosmic sugar daddy, their little lackey, you know, who kind of does little tiny favors as if God cares so much about where they might find a parking place. And I just have to remind myself every bit as much as I feel the need to remind the rest of us that God's ways and his thoughts are inscrutable, that we never figure them out. We never can presume his favor or disfavor by the events going on in our lives. We can have hints of it, for sure. We can have a thought about it. We can have an inkling. Incidentally, that's why they were called the Inklings, C.S. Lewis and Tolkien and William and all the rest, they had inklings, and that's as good as it gets. You have an inkling about something, and so you should follow that. Chase your hunches. Follow them down. Sniff them down. Go for it. But never presume to know beyond any shadow of a doubt God's will. You may get your comeuppance. Von Rott puts it this way.
Sorry. He was there in prison, and the Lord was with Joseph and showed him steadfast love.
That's, you know, I'm not on social media, but I assume that many of you have Facebook pages, and I guess don't people like have quotes on their Facebook page, like famous quotes? Isn't that true? Anyway, this would be, no, they don't? Oh, well. Well, anyway, find a place that has quotes and put that one up there. Or better yet, hang it in your bathroom over your mirror, because that's a quote no one has. I can assure you, I promise you, no one in the history of Christendom has that quote. But I think that has more to say about God's inscrutable providence and his mystery than anything else. That he was in prison and God was showing Joseph his steadfast love and favor. Joseph has now sunk one degree lower, but there too he is protected by God's care. Obviously, the statement Yahweh was with him implies quite real protection and promotion in the matters of his external life. Not, to be sure, protection from distress, but rather in the midst of distress. Thank you. The narrator's theology is not so naive. On the contrary, the way he combines emphatic belief in God's protection and presence with the permission of severe afflictions is amazing. I love how Von Rott puts that. It's just that this lovely paradox, this counterbalance, this ballast that we all have to have in our faith. And I think, honestly, I really believe this, that one of the grave missteps that the church has taken is in assuming a one-to-one correlation between God's will and our success or failure. And I think that is such a common misstep to make. And the more you feed yourself from the gospel of Joel Osteen, the more commonly you will make this mistake. But it doesn't have to just be Joel Osteen. He's just the low-hanging fruit. He's the easy target. It can seep through even the best theologians of any church. It can seep through the best sermons, the most well-intended sermons from the best preachers. Because we want it to be true. We want to believe that if we get God's favor and love, then everything will turn out okay for us. It'll be fine. And the Bible shows us otherwise, and no one less than Von Rott calls it amazing. Isn't it amazing? It's so amazing. Joseph has now sunk one degree lower, and the passage he's actually referring to here is when, that we're going to talk about a little bit later in the class, is when he's then accused of adultery, right? So now he's sunk one degree lower than being a prisoner. But there too, he is protected by God's care. Isn't that interesting that God's care for us, his love for us, does not preclude our suffering? We ought to know this because of the life of Jesus. We ought to know that when Jesus was hanging on the cross, it wasn't because God was having a bad day, or that he was smarting towards his son, or didn't like something his son said. He's absolutely in the midst of God's love and care. And even the Son, Jesus, who is mysteriously God himself, yells out to his Father, "My God, why have you abandoned me?" Of course, God has not abandoned him. In one real sense, God did, but in another sense, he didn't. And it's that inscrutable thing. So there too, he is protected by God's care. But God's care for us, again, I just need to repeat it, will not preclude suffering in our lives, will not preclude struggle. Obviously, the statement Yahweh was with him implies quite real protection and even promotion in the matters of his external life.
So it's not like God's care for us doesn't matter at all or doesn't make any difference. Of course it does. It can make all kinds of difference. It can actually even lead to promotion, as he says, and protection in our external life, which, again, for those of us, you know, who are a little bit more to the left politically and more socially conscious, we think, well, that's a little bit, isn't that kind of a little bit tawdry of God to be interested in our promotion when there are so many people struggling? No, God's actually interested in our promotion, in our protection in some real sense. It's not like God is disappointed when we're successful. But notice how Von Rott continues, but not to be sure protection from distress, but rather in the midst of distress. I just can't get enough of it. Sorry, I know I'm repeating myself. The narrator's theology is not so naive that God protects us from distress. What crazy person thinks that? What theologian worth his or her salt would ever say that? That's incredibly naive. He's with us in the midst of our distress. On the contrary, the way he combines emphatic belief, the narrator, in God's protection and presence with the permission of severe afflictions is amazing. Anyway, I really like that. Far as the curse is found. Remember that song we played last year around this time? Far as the curse is found. I love that. In that great Christmas hymn. That God's promise and love covers the curse as far as it is found. Doesn't erase the curse, but covers it. And here are two things we should know, two things we learn from these verses, which illustrates, I think, a much larger truth that shimmers through all of Scripture. I've already hinted at it, but I just want to now codify it. God does not micromanage our lives. He does not prevent us from tragedy, from disappointments, from getting into personal and professional pickles. Bad things happen even to faithful Christians. This is, I know now, it's almost become a cliche, but it's a cliche that no one believes. Bad things happen even to faithful Christians. And number two, God never abandons us, never forsakes us, never stops loving us. Nothing can ever separate us from the love of God, Romans 8. Nothing, no tragedy, no run of bad luck, no betrayal, no sin. And those two things, that God does not micromanage our lives, but he does not abandon us, I think of that great and wise line from 38 Special, hold on loosely, but don't let go. God is there with us, Emmanuel. He is present with us. He doesn't micromanage our lives. He doesn't step in at every breach of injustice and fix it. He doesn't prevent us from stubbing our toes. He doesn't micromanage us, but he never abandons us. And somewhere in that tension lies all of life. He doesn't leave us. He never leaves us. But he also isn't, you know, this busybody. He gives us a life to live. Jen and I saw a fantastic movie this weekend, The Two Popes, which anything that Anthony Hopkins is in, I love to watch. And it was terrific. Jonathan Pryce was fabulous. It was a great movie. But at one point, and they said, you know, the critique of the movie is that it's not terribly historically accurate. Well, whatever. It's a movie, you know, it's fiction. But it's pretty fascinating. And in any case, at one point, there's a line in there about the will that we've been given to use. And we need to use that will. And God allows us to do it. And I think that this is a useful reminder for all of us, no matter where we are, whether we're in a good place in our lives right now or a not so good place in our lives, or maybe, as like most of us, somewhere in the middle, right? It's always very Dickensian, particularly around Christmas. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. There's always a French Revolution going on inside of our psyche at some point, right? And now look at this. This is interesting. But the Lord, I'm reading from verse 21, and I'm reading out of Von Rott's translation. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him steadfast love and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison committed all the prisoners to his care, and he was the one who determined everything that happened there.
The keeper of the prison paid no heed to anything that was in Joseph's care, because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made it prosper. Now compare these lines to the opening lines of the pericope, and you'll find it pretty, and I use a word, by the way, pericope. It's a biblical word that just means a particular closed unit of Scripture. Usually it follows along the lines of chapters, but not always. Sometimes a pericope bleeds over into another chapter, because chapters and verses, as you know, were not written into Scripture to begin with. And then the editors got a little sloppy. So the first example is they get sloppy at Genesis 2. Because Genesis 2 bleeds actually into what we now call Genesis 3. Anyway, so this is a pericope. And here's the first part. The Lord was with Joseph, and he became a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And his master saw that the Lord was with him, that the Lord caused all that he had to prosper in his hands. So Joseph found favor in Potiphar's sight and became his assistant. And he made him overseer of his house and put him in charge of all that he had. From the time that he had made him overseer in his house and over all that he had, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. The blessing of the Lord was upon all that Potiphar had in house and field. So Potiphar left all that he had in Joseph's charge, and having him, he had no concern for anything but the food which he ate. Look at the parallels here.
So we'll start with
verse 4a and verse 21. So Joseph found favor in Potiphar's sight. Verse 21, but the Lord gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. Verse 4b, and he made him overseer of his house and put him in charge of all that he had. Verse 22, and the keeper of the prison committed all the prisoners to his care. Verse 6a, so Potiphar left all that he had in Joseph's charge. Verse 22b, and he was the one who determined everything that happened there in the prison. Verse 6b, and having him, he had no concern for anything. Verse 23a, the keeper of the prison paid no heed to anything that was in Joseph's care. And finally, verse 3, and his master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord caused all that he did to prosper. And verse 23b, because the Lord was with him and whatever he did, the Lord made it prosper. This parallelism that happens at the beginning of 39 and at the end of 39 is interesting. I find it actually significant, theologically speaking and biblically speaking. And what's interesting to me is that von Rott makes no mention of this parallel structure. And I'm surprised by that, because von Rott typically catches way more than I do. But this, for some reason, he didn't catch. And I checked. I thought, well, maybe the parallelism isn't in the Hebrew. But it's in the Hebrew, too. In fact, if I had the time, I would have put up the Hebrew as well. It's even more there's even more of an obvious parallel structure in the Hebrew. And I think this is significant for a couple of reasons. And I want to look at this for a minute. In both cases, Joseph is in his captivity. In the beginning of the pericope, he's simply a slave, a servant who has found favor in his master's sight. And then in the last part, he's actually a prisoner. So he is one step lower. But in both cases, he's in captivity, first as a slave, then as a prisoner. And in both cases, God's treatment of Joseph is the same. Isn't that interesting? I mean, this is quite a parallel here. Joseph is being treated exactly the same, consistently. God's presence in our lives, in other words, is consistent, no matter the particularities of our lives. Our circumstances change, right? But God's love for us, his desire to make us a blessing, those don't change. And his blessings aren't circumstance dependent. God will use us when things are great. Will use us when things are not so great. Will use us when things are awful. And he will make us a blessing if we allow him to. And I thought about this. You know, God operates in time. Of course he does, because we are in time. But his perspective is from out of time. He sees what we don't see. He remembers what we have forgotten. He's able to see what we can't possibly imagine, which gives his actions in our lives a decisive steadiness. There is a steadfastness to God. And it doesn't feel that way a lot of times to us, because God is able to see where things are going in ways we simply can't. So for us, it seems a little mercurial at times, like, gosh, God answered this prayer, but he didn't answer that prayer. And God seemed to be very present with me here, but he seems entirely absent with me there. And I think we have to remind ourselves that God His love for us, His desire to make us a blessing, His steadfast commitment to us does not change based on our circumstance. That there may be times indeed when God, His presence in our lives is more mysterious and harder to find out and more inscrutable. But that's not because He's changed. It's because our circumstances have changed. Maybe because our willingness to listen has changed. Maybe our ability to hear Him has changed. God is the same yesterday, today, tomorrow. His presence is an anchor. It's a ballast against the vicissitudes of life. And you know, we know this, right? Circumstances change. People change, obviously. People come and go. But the Lord remains. The Spirit of God remains our advocate and our friend. We may be lost and weary, searching for a way to go, to quote a popular song, might be heavy-hearted or disillusioned by anything, by the frenetic pace of this season. But God remains Emmanuel. God remains with us. And I don't know about you, but I find that very salutary, that God's favor that rests upon us, that God's love for us, God's desire to see us be redeemed, God's plans for us, they remain consistent. They remain with us through all that we experience. And we, as tempted as we might be, to assume that at certain points God is closer and sometimes He's farther away, that's not only, I think, bad theology, it's just not good physics. God's presence is with us always, and He remains the constant. God is the great constant amidst all of the change of our lives, both individually and corporately, politically, ecologically, in every way, God remains consistent. And I think sometimes we can, it's sort of that Galileo Kepler conundrum, right? That it looks like the sun is moving around us, but we're actually moving around the sun. It can seem like God comes and goes, but actually we're the ones who come and go. It looks the same if we're not paying attention, but God remains with us. And now let's take a look at the middle of this chapter, the really, you know, juicy part, where Joseph is tempted by Potiphar's wife, which is the central conflict in this passage, by the way. And interestingly, Von Rott, and I found this fascinating, when Von Rott talks about this, he doesn't credit Joseph's high moral character as the reason that Joseph is able to withstand Potiphar's wife's constant entreaties. Is that interesting? Because we would be tempted, I think, to assume, gosh, way to go, Joseph. Take one for the team. You did this. You're good job, right? You didn't succumb. Well done. Man, you are a man of high character. No, Von Rott says it's Joseph's fear of God's punishment that makes him so well behaved. Von Rott writes, "The fear of God is what binds Joseph." And I thought about that for a minute, and I thought, you know, he's right. It is the fear of God that binds Joseph, and we see this actually in the text. But before we look at that, isn't that a mark of character? I mean, I think so. I actually think that a mark of character is the fear of the Lord. And I don't think we have a healthy enough fear of the Lord. In fact, I think that's half the church's problem. Is we're so hell-bent on being politically correct about salvation that we have nothing to fear. You have nothing to fear but fear itself. But I think the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And apparently not just the beginning of wisdom, but the beginning of moral character. Knowing what to fear, knowing what lines not to cross, and then not crossing them. Isn't that what virtue is? It seems to me that virtue, if it isn't exercising self-control and discipline, it certainly is that. It's also knowing what to fear and then putting that fear into practice. It makes perfect sense to me, actually. A virtuous person isn't someone who doesn't struggle with sin. A virtuous person is one who struggles with sin and perseveres. Because maybe it's fear or sheer discipline or likely more a combination of both. But it seems to me the fear of the Lord is precisely the most wonderful motivation for not doing a bad thing. Now, every once in a while, it may be that you don't want to do the bad thing because you just feel like your conscience is, you know, indicting you. But isn't that a version of the fear of the Lord? That you're doing the wrong thing? That you shouldn't do it? Maybe sometimes we're motivated by altruistic reasons that, well, if I were in that person's place, I wouldn't want someone to do that to me. So yeah, that sometimes can motivate. But can I just tell you from personal experience, and maybe I'm confessing too much here, but that doesn't always work. I'm not a good enough person to think that often enough, or at least I don't have enough self-control to let that be my sole motivation. Well, I wouldn't want to have that. That's why the golden rule is a really poor substitute for the gospel. Because all of us can recite the golden rule, very few of us actually follow it. Do unto others what you would have them do unto you. Let's see what Joseph says. This is his version of, Mrs. Robinson, are you trying to seduce me? And you know, I'd only tell that joke in Hollywood. It would fly right over the heads of everyone in Spokane or everyone else. I don't even have to make the reference. And you guys all laughed. And those of you who don't know the joke, you laughed anyway because you don't want to feel left out. But he refused and said to his master's wife, lo, having me, my master has no concern about anything in the house. And he's put everything that he has in my hand. He is not greater in this house than I am, nor has he kept back anything from me except yourself, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? And Von Rott thinks that 9b is the crucial text. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? He writes, Von Rott says, this is the most important part of the speech. The ethos is completely and consciously bound to God. So this is so interesting, right? I don't entirely agree with what Von Rott says there at the end, that the ethos, the sense of this, of Joseph's moral character is completely and consciously bound to God. Maybe I'm misunderstanding him, but Von Rott doesn't appear to entirely agree with himself, because he writes this a little bit later, but his point is solid, and we're going to jump to it. But he says this: it is, however, noteworthy that Joseph, in addition, uses this argument of universal human decency, which is unwilling to break a trust, right? So there is this sense of universal human decency. Like, how could I do this to your husband? He gave me all this stuff. That wouldn't be right. Okay, fair enough. But then Von Rott says, but wait a minute. The actual thing that keeps Joseph morally, you know, his character secured is his fear of God. But it also includes this sort of universal appeal, this argument of universal human decency. It kind of makes you nostalgic, doesn't it? This argument, universal human decency. Where the hell did that go? We're not even making that argument anymore, universal human decency. How quaint. Have you been watching the impeachment hearings? They're enough to make you absolutely depressed. In fact, my brother, as is his wont, regales his family with articles from the Washington Post and the New York Times at least 5 times a day. And it's great because he's our personal reader. He reads everything that's worth reading and then he sends it to us. If you don't have a personal reader, you're missing out on one of life's great, and I have two, my brother and my mother. She sends me articles from the New Yorker and from the New York Review of Books, and my brother sends me articles from the New York Times. So it's lovely. I have my minions out there who But my brother sent us an article, and it's one of the best written articles I've ever read on the state of people's anxiety in this political maelstrom we find ourselves in. How terrible. There is no more argument for universal human decency, it seems. There are a couple folks who appear to be decent still, and you just pray for their character, that they can remain so. But so many people are just so terrible, and it just is. So anyway, von Rott says, it's noteworthy that Joseph, in addition, uses this argument of universal human decency, which is unwilling to break a trust. But, von Rott says, but don't be mistaken, that's not what keeps Joseph walking that fine line. It's his fear of God. And here's a larger point that I think is really central to what I'm saying this morning. And it's central, really, to any notion of theological ethics. If you're dealing with theological ethics at all, there's a central sort of fundamental truth, and it's this, that ethics divorced from a divine directive or decree has no basis. You can't simply talk about ethics without a theological context, lest it be simply, at best, wishful thinking. At best, a good faith effort based on the mercurial human will. At best, an appeal to human decency. But an ethic or a system of ethics of human decency separated from the ground of moral order isn't worth the paper it's written on. Why? Because it's the people in power who determine what is ethical. Don't we see this now? We're living through an experiment of grand social proportions. The United States of America has become a socio-political petri dish. And we are all a massive experiment right now in seeing how those in power can actually change the conversation. They can change what we believe is true. They can change what the ethical tone is. So without a grounding that lies at the fundamentals of existence, ethics is just whatever anyone happens to think is right who also happens to be in power. In many respects, that's really, it's at best an appeal to human decency, an ethics that depends on the virtue of the perpetrator, and that's what human ethics divorced from a theological context is. It's depending on us, you and me. That's who it depends on, and we're the perpetrators. We're the ones who need an ethic, and we're the ones inventing it. It's on us. We decide, physician, heal thyself. A sickness that depends on the diseased host for healing is a tenuous system indeed. I have a book that I bought years ago when I was going through my little period of struggling with atheism. And it's a series of essays. It's a thick book, 400 pages of separate essays written by the world's most eminent atheist philosophers on how you can have an ethical system devoid of any appeal to God. And I was fascinated by this book because I thought, these are some serious thinkers. I mean, these people have spent their entire lives really sort of plumbing the depths of existence. And it's so interesting. And I was disappointed. I was ready to be challenged and ready to really, and I was. I mean, some essays are better than others for sure, but not a single one of them made a cogent argument from my perspective on how you can have a system of ethics that is set up by the perpetrator of that ethics, namely us. How can we do it? It might work sometimes. Maybe the appeal to human decency has worked for you. It's worked for me a few times. But I think it works sometimes in the way that a broken clock is right twice a day. We get lucky. Circumstances worked out. We had a good day. We weren't tempted too far. And our basic human decency made us do the right thing. But I think all too often we shirk the role that God plays, whether consciously or unconsciously, in the virtues that we try to have in our lives. Ludwig Wittgenstein, probably the greatest philosopher of the 20th century, he has this famous line in his Tacitus: the solution to the problem of time and space must come outside of time and space. I've said this in this class before, but it's one of those great little truths that bears repeating. The solution to the problem of time and space must come outside of time and space. Well, folks, the solution to the problem of human sin must come outside of human sin. The solution to the problem of the human condition must come outside of the human condition. All our attempts, all of our efforts, devoid of God to heal ourselves, is just fraught with problems. And left to our own devices, we will send ourselves and others to hell eventually. Without something to appeal to outside of us. And this is what makes the revelation of the gospel in Jesus Christ so profoundly true. Because it's not merely a God stepping from the outside in and waving some wand and making everything somehow better. But it's a God who decided to step into our misery, join us in the midst of that misery, as if that was a kind of mise en abyme. You know, it was a truth within a truth, within a truth, within a truth, within a truth. Oh, do you want to know how God works in your life? Oh, well, look at Jesus. Did Jesus go around just simply, you know, alleviating every problem anyone ever had? Just ask the disciples how their lives ended. Now, did he cure diseases? Absolutely. Did he have some miracles to perform? Of course. Did he make life a Thomas Kincaid painting? No, decidedly not. Well, if this is how Jesus works and Jesus is God, then this must be how God works. God steps into our lives in a way that we can't, I mean, God was there to begin with. He doesn't step into our lives. He is our life. We step into His. We're born into His reality. He's the one that sustains us and keeps us, but He doesn't. Again, it's that tension, right? He doesn't micromanage, but He's there. He is the solution to the problem of human sin. Because He stands outside of human sin, and yet He entered into it. And it's this double movement that no other religion on the planet has ever attempted. It's this double movement where God is fully us in Jesus Christ and fully God at the same time. The other significant thing, I don't think this can be overstated. Another way of putting this, I suppose, is that our sins may be our own, but our virtues are gifts from God, made possible only by Him, and which are effected only in concert with Him. And again, I need to add this, because I think it would be irresponsible of me not to, which isn't to say that those not in relationship with the living God are incapable of virtues. That's simply not true. I mean, it begs the question, who of us on the planet is not in some sort of relationship with God? I think even an atheist is in a relationship with God, particularly if they're a committed atheist. Then they're in a real interesting relationship with God. It's a very antagonistic one. But their very name betrays their position. They are an atheist, but you got to have theist in there to define who they are. They are against God. They are like Kierkegaard said. It's not so much that they don't believe in God. They just don't want to believe in Him. And so they push up against His existence. So in some sense, we're all in relationship to God, I suppose. But all of the virtues that people are somehow able, you and I are able, in some sense, to cultivate on our own, those virtues are proximate virtues, right? And Romans 1 says this. Romans 1 says you don't need Jesus Christ. You don't need His death on the cross. You don't even need the Gospels. You don't need the Bible to know that God exists. There's a virtue in that. You ought to have a conscience, Paul says, in a number of places. You ought to know what's right and wrong without Jesus. And people do. But all of our virtues, sans God, are proximate virtues. They're temporary virtues. They're not the ground of all being, right? They are shadows of the true virtues. They are virtues reliant upon the argument of universal human decency alone, which is a poor substitute for the creator of that universe and the author of all that is truly decent. The other fascinating element in this story is how quickly love turns to hate, or at least we think, maybe I should put it this way, how quickly lust turns to hate. That's a better way of putting it. Lust has no basis in love. In fact, I am convinced, having been a repository of lust in my life, that it is actually a form of hate. I think to lust after someone is secretly to hate them. That wouldn't be what you would say or think, but I'll tell you why I think that, because it insists on objectifying the object of its desire. It turns that thing you're lusting after, well, into a thing. Not into a person. Not into someone you see as part of God's creation, as a whole person. No, you've turned that person into an object. You've objectified them and then therefore lusted after them. You cannot love an object for the very same reason you cannot love an idol. Because love in its very nature is relational. That's what binds the Trinity together in this beautiful hypostatic union, it's called, is the love of the three persons of the Trinity for each other. Love is inherently relational, which is why you really can't love Wisconsin six cheese pizza from Domino's. It is entirely possible to lust after it, however, as my son and I occasionally do. But you can't love it, just like you can't love money. You can lust after money. But this is why the love of money is the root of all evil, because there's a little play on that. You're loving something that doesn't love you back. You're desiring something that can't desire you. So you're lusting after it. Love requires two subjects, so lust is always hate disguised by desire. I am convinced of that. That lust is always hate disguised by desire. By a desire to make someone a means to an end, to turn them into a tool for your own use and pleasure. Nevertheless, this lust in this story in Genesis 39 is persistent and must have been difficult for Joseph to spurn, to turn away, and yet he does. And I thought about this. I teach this in my class, too, with my students, that false virtues are always disguised vices. False virtues are always disguised vices, just like every vice is a distorted virtue. There's this wonderful relationship between vices and virtues, and we cover that in 1 week of our class together, and I'm afraid it goes over most of my students' heads, but I like to think it's what I call a 10-year lecture. You won't understand it for 10 years. And in 10 years, you'll be walking down the aisles of Home Depot looking for some, you know, extra spackle that you needed for your job in your bathroom. And something about the spackle will remind you of our lecture in CLFM on virtues and vices. False virtues are always disguised vices. Every vice is a distorted virtue. Every virtue has its shadow side, and taken too far becomes its shadow. Let me give you a few examples. Chastity can become prudishness. Chastity is a virtue. Prudishness is just a pain in the ass. Prudishness, there's nothing good about prudish, a prude, someone who doesn't want it. You know, it's, it reminds me of that definition of a Puritan, right. I was thinking of the American equivalent of a Pharisee. The definition of a Puritan is someone with the nagging fear that someone somewhere is having a good time. So chastity can become prudishness. Temperance can become priggishness. A temperate person is good. You know, they're temperate in their use of alcohol, temperate in their use of money, temperate. But you can become a prig, where you're an Ebenezer Scrooge. Charity can become prodigality. Diligence taken to an excessive degree can become obsessive compulsive behavior. Patience distorted becomes enabling. Kindness becomes obsequiousness. Humility becomes self-loathing, and so on and so forth. So every virtue has its shadow side, and taken too far becomes a vice. In any case, Potiphar's wife tries to seduce Joseph, I'm sure with flatteries of all kinds. We read, after all, that she speaks to him day after day after day. But he isn't swayed. He knows a lout when he sees one. And I would be remiss if I didn't bring up chapter 38 at this point, that mysterious chapter that we skipped, and that if you read, you know why we skipped. But now I feel compelled to actually talk about it for the last 5 minutes we have in this class. I know, why? Well, you'll see. Hopefully I will make a compelling case. It has, in some sense, no relevance to the Joseph story. It's just stuck there right in the middle. But there is one way in which it is entirely relevant to the Joseph story, and in particular to this part of the Joseph story, and that is because of its weird and excessive focus on adulterous relationships and incest and prostitution and masturbation. I mean, it's the craziest chapter. It's so weird. It's all there. I wrote here in all its naked glory, pun intended. But it reads literally like an ancient Near Eastern daytime soap. If you're bored today, just read chapter 38 of Genesis. I'm a little bit loath to say that with people younger than 20 in this room, but anyway, there you have it. Here's my point, and I feel obliged to mention this in our oversexed, undersatisfied, perpetually prurient culture. Sexual indiscretions are the low-hanging fruit of sin. Sexual indiscretions are the low-hanging fruit of sin. They are the go-to temptation, I think, that preys on our basest and most primal human instincts. Sexual indiscretions also happen to be, in many cases, I think, for this very reason, the most effective means by which people fall out of obedience to God and to each other. It's one of the most ubiquitous ways that we fall away, but it's one of the most unsophisticated ways that we fall away. It's so conventional. It's so obvious. It's also, to me it seems at least, the gateway drug in some respects to many other indiscretions. That if we can fall away with sexual indiscretions, it's not a huge leap to fall away in other indiscretions. And I think it's interesting to me, I struggle with this a little bit. I think for that reason, it pays for us to be aware and diligent against the siren calls of indiscretion that are all around us, whether on TV, the shows we watch, the music we listen to, the social media we engage in. It is in the air we breathe. We must guard against it with courage and discipline. We must guard against it with more than just the argument from universal human decency. If you are trying to struggle with lust by an appeal to universal human decency, good flipping luck. God must be present. God must be there and must be a source of strength for us. I'm seeing an entire culture disintegrate in a sea of temptations and distorted desire. And it both saddens me and it scares me. And I wouldn't have had this existential commitment to it if I wasn't raising children in this culture. It just makes me sad. It makes me sad what my 14-year-old daughter is exposed to, that I was never exposed to unless I was willing to go down to 7-Eleven and make a purchase that I was too young to make. Now it's forced into our rooms, into our bedrooms, into our households, and it never stops, 24/7. I go to my junk mail, and it's constantly teasing itself out. It's like Potiphar's wife. Our culture has become Potiphar's wife. It feels strange to bring such a thing up, I suppose, in the midst of a Sunday school class, But the very texts we read are often full of it, like Genesis 38. And we see the reality of this crisis, or we deny the reality of this crisis, rather, at our own peril as individual Christians and as the church. Indeed, isn't it? Couldn't one say it's the central crisis of the church, at least one, the one that gets the most press? And it has to do precisely with this issue of sex and sexual identity. And if we're not careful, we will drown not only in a sea of excess, which our culture provides us free of charge, but we will drown in a sea of distorted virtues, which will use the language of virtues to promote vices. That's what will happen. It will use virtuous language to promote vice. It has done this for thousands of years and will do so for 1,000 years more, and we have to be diligent, able to parse subtle distinctions beyond, be able to see beyond the pale of contemporary culture to the horizon, lift our eyes to the hills from whence salvation comes is another way of seeing this. If we allow culture to set the terms, we've already lost the debate. And I had a friend contact me by phone the other day. I'm sorry, I'm going a little bit over. Just give me 2 more minutes. Asking him if I could help him draft a statement related to sexual purity and what he and I believe that actually means. He runs a summer camp for kids that my daughter Belle goes to. But instead of encouraging him to take up arms against the oppressors of this, which is all too common a tactic in these cultural battles for our souls and allegiances, I said to Andy, I encouraged him to make a positive statement that celebrates sexuality as it was originally intended, and not to feel like he needed to respond to culture's fashionable mores. We were here first, I said. Let them make the statement against us. Let us as the church make the positive statement. They can choose to respond if they feel the need. And I am increasingly convinced, not only as I read the Bible, but when I read the newspaper, that we are a people lost at sea. We are unable to find our bearings, relying merely on some distorted views of human, universal human decency, unwilling to follow the hard and often inconvenient truths of the gospel. And as my homegirl Flannery O'Connor once reminded us, the truth does not change according to our ability to stomach it. All human nature vigorously resists grace because grace changes us, and change is painful. You know, Joseph could have easily succumbed, and we probably wouldn't be reading his story today if he did. Thankfully, he did not. He was willing to look beyond appearances, beyond the immediate, to something bigger and deeper and more important, not only with Potiphar's wife and all that happened there, but with his brothers who tried to kill him, and we'll see this next week, where his temperance and his patience and his chastity, these true virtues, which all find their basis in his fear of the Lord, this is theological ethics at its finest, because he's taking that argument for universal human decency, but he's inculcating it and peppering it and tilling it with the fear of the Lord. And I'm convinced that we need to fear the Lord more, if only that we might fear the world less. If we don't fear the Lord enough, we will fear the world too much. I'm sorry I went over, but that's an excuse for me not to take any questions or comments. Have a good week, and I'll see you next week.